Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Jack Lepiarz. Tonight, we have a discussion presented by the Boston University Center for the Study of Europe, the Frederick S. Pardee School of Global Studies, and the Goethe Institute Boston. Our discussion is titled Quo Vadis Europe. Speaking will be Joachim Fritz Venama, director of the think tank Europe's Future at the Bertelsmann Stiftung. Tonight's moderator is Center for the Study of Europe founding director Vivian Schmidt. We begin with an introduction by Christoph Mutscher, director of the Goethe Institute Boston.
I'm really glad to having two wonderful experts here on stage. I'm really looking forward myself to hear and listen what they have to say. And a little trigger warning before, what you might hear might be rather dark at the end. So if you don't feel like dark, there's a chance to go out. So it's time to give a big welcome to our guests. Ladies first, Vivian Schmidt. Vivian Schmidt has a wonderful German name, which is already a good start for her to be an expert on Europe. She's not perfect in German yet, but she's going to Berlin soon and brush up her German. She's a regular guest in France, and she is professor at Boston University for political science. And she's the founder of this wonderful Center for the Study on Europe. A great expert on Europe, and we're really happy having you here, Vivian. From Germany, Joachim Fritz Venama has been working for Die Zeit, the leading German weekly, and he's been working in Brussels and in Paris, and then changed sides, became, as a journalist, the director for the study of Europe of the Bertelsmann Stiftung, Bertelsmann Foundation, probably the leading German think tank on all things political, economical, educational. So two wonderful experts on Europe, and I'm going to shut down and listen to what they have to say. Enjoy the evening, and yeah.
So thank you so much for that wonderful introduction, and I think I'll just start. And I suppose the way to start is to say, or is to ask our guest, the question that I think everyone in this room has, you all have on your minds, which is why is the European Union in such a mess? And so I suppose what I'd have to do is tell us about the many crises, or which crises you see as most significant, and later we'll ask you how we get out of those crises. But first, so what? How do you see the EU? What are its crises? Which is the worst one? Why don't we start there?
Before I start with the gloomy parts of my introduction, Vivian, let me first of all thank you and Boston University for having invited me here, and the Goethe Institute for having made this possible and this evening possible. Well, I might start with a personal remark. When I stranded as a young journalist in the early 80s in France, everybody was talking about eurosclerosis. And everybody said that was a wonderful idea in the 50s, but now it's running dead. It's empty, the machine doesn't turn anymore. And everybody was wondering, is there any solution, any sign, any glimpse of hope? Yeah, there wasn't. And then there came not the messiahs, but a man who did a good job, Jacques Delors. And in the lapse of 2-3 years, quickly we started to talk about the single market, we had a project, and things improved, and then came the Big Bang, the Iron Curtain disappeared, and Europe was what it is today. So in my career, I have seen situations which were a little bit similar to what we have today, where I would have said also a mess. You're absolutely right to use the word. When I'm a little bit more pessimistic today, then for two reasons. One is, once again, and that's unfortunately an exercise where European Union excels in a fantastic way, we are inward looking in a moment when we should look on the world. the world is turning around and is moving and changing so quickly. And exactly at that situation, we are inward looking. That's, for example, one of the key differences between the 80s and today. At that time, we had the well-organized Cold War. Things seemed to be clear. And so it was really up to the Europeans to find their way. Today, they can find their way. If they find their way, I have doubts, and I will tell you why. But nobody is waiting for us. Yeah? And that is one thing which I often say to audiences in Europe. Yeah, we can here discuss problems between Germany and France, or between Hungary and Germany and Italy and Germany. Yeah? But if we go on like this today, then we are really not only in a mess, we might be lost. My analysis is that today Europe is in a deep, deep crisis, but not yet in a breakup situation. So decline, yes, decay, no. It's sad enough to say that to this audience, to all other audiences I've been with over the last months. In my view, in my analysis, we have seven crises at the same time in Europe. Yeah? I call them quite often the seven plagues or the seven sins. Yeah? It's up to you to make your choice. Yeah? Because we are the sinners. Quite often we are responsible for what's going on, what's happening. First of all, and that is certainly for the citizen in Europe, all countries together, the most revolting and the most shocking and the most surprising experience is the mix-up between migration and refugees to become a crisis. Yeah. We at the Foundation analyze that for years as a kind of mixed flow. Yeah. So it is very, very difficult to make a clear and administrative distinction between refugees, asylum seekers, and migrants who come for perhaps very good reasons, but who, in our view, are by definition economic migrants. And the unresolved refugee and migration crisis comes first. Yeah. Then we have a second crisis, which is the unresolved security crisis. Inside the security crisis is, of course, terrorism. Quite often homegrown, homemade, so not imported from outside. But it is troubling the French, the Germans in the meantime. Yeah, the Spaniards had their experience, the British had their experiences. So it is a European problem. And also we have that, problem of security as an outside crisis, which is the crisis in Europe's front garden. I say front garden and not so much neighborhood, yeah, because if you look after the distance between Morocco and Spain, it's some 40, 50 kilometers. If it's between Tunisia and Italy, it's some 40, 50 kilometers. All this is going on in our front garden, and we knew about that for quite a while. We didn't know what would happen, but we knew there is something going on. There are problems in our front garden which sooner or later become explosive and will put us into trouble. The third crisis, perhaps, Vivian, you are the most interested in, we will see, is, of course, the unresolved euro crisis. We have a monetary union without an economic union, and we pay a high price of instability for that for a couple of years already. We see that the cohesion, which was one of the promises of the euro would help that the cohesion between, economic cohesion between countries as different as Greece and Germany or Portugal and Denmark, yeah, could find, sorry, Denmark's not a member, but let me say the Netherlands, yeah, could help to foster a stronger European Union. Yeah, this has not happened, and this is not going to happen over the next couple of years. Nevertheless, the unresolved euro crisis asks for a better structure and a better decision making inside the euro for years now, and we are very hesitating, our leaders are very hesitating to go in this direction. We have linked to that, but of a different origin, after the financial crisis of 2008, still an unresolved banking union. We started to go in this direction, and if you would have told me 5 years ago what we would have today, I would have said, no, never, not in 5 years. So in the negative is something positive, but that's perhaps the only really encouraging message I have among this list of seven crises to give to you this evening. We have not only a lack of cohesion, but a growing divergence between, instead of convergence, between the member states. This is true both individually, if you take country by country, but we also have a kind of subtle breakup of the European Union in groups. We have the Visegrad groups of the four new members from 2004. We have Poland, Hungary, Slovak and Czech Republic. Yeah. We have most recently the Southern Summit, yeah, with the Mediterranean countries, including France. It was not France who pushed for that, but they accepted the invitation by the Italian Prime Minister. And so on. So you might say, where's union in this kind of disunion? Yeah. And we have, that's my sixth point, high unemployment rates in nearly all our countries, and a particularly shocking high youth unemployment rate in the southern countries in the crisis. Spain has a youth unemployment rate of nearly 50%. We are depriving a whole generation of the advantage of Europe. And this will hit back one day. Until today, they try to find a better solution thanks to the single market elsewhere. But this can't go on for years. In my view, this is one of the first points where we have really start to be creative and to find new solutions, because it is domestic, but it is not only domestic, it is also European, and we will see. Last but not least, and that is perhaps the point I should put in the first place, because it is what preoccupies me most. We have an explosion of egotism among the leaders. Normally, European affairs often are said by Europeans, oh, that's so complicated, your institutional set in Brussels, I can't understand all this. Though I try to make it a little bit easier, saying we have a process which is well organized and well implemented. It starts with a C, it goes on with a C, and it ends with a C. The first is confrontation. It always starts in Europe with confrontation between member states, governments, factions, and so on. Next is coalition building. You find others who think like you, and the others find others who say, no, that's not the way to do things. Yeah. And the last C is always compromise. And this is not very sexy, as a French intellectual once said, I know, but it works. It works. Or I must say it worked, yeah. Because today it doesn't work anymore. Yeah. We have confrontation, we have coalition building, but we don't have the compromises necessary to move ahead. You might wonder, there's one key element missing in this list. I didn't mention Brexit until now. For good reason, because as far as I see, the Brexit is first of all originated as a problem in United Kingdom, more specifically in England and not in Britain. No. The Scots don't have that problem. They voted differently in the referendum, and everybody expected that. Northern Ireland voted differently. Wales was a little bit like England. England, 80% of United Kingdom, has the problem, is the problem, and has the problem not so much with Brussels and the institutions, but with its own view of its own future and a kind of sentimental, glorified wish to be as England was yesterday. Yeah. And these eight elements finally all together make the political situation in Europe messy. Yeah, you are right to say that. And traditionally, the answer when things are not going in the right direction and well is we need leadership.
Okay, that's great. So we've heard about a whole range of crises, with the sort of the last but possibly the most significant for you is the crisis of leadership. There's an elephant in the room that hasn't been mentioned: Germany. And if we talk about a crisis of leadership, if you talk about the problems with the Eurozone, and also the refugee crisis. Remember that Chancellor Merkel, with the refugee crisis, having been seen as devil or dictator with the Eurozone crisis, turns around with the refugee crisis and becomes angel and is on the cover of Time magazine. I guess the big question for me is, to what extent can we blame lots of these crises on Germany? Move it even farther, in the sense that there are those who argue that the Eurozone crisis, which I would argue is the crisis of crises, it was the beginning. You didn't mention as a crisis the rise of populism, but one could also add that to the list. So I guess the question is, what is the role of Germany, and why has it seemed to be at the center of this? And there are people who talk about Germany as the reluctant hegemon, that it could have taken action, it didn't. The Greek crisis maybe never needed to have happened to have caused the Eurozone crisis if it had been rescued immediately. 2 billion euros is not so much when you think of actually how much has been lost in terms of value added from all of Europe. So what is it about Germany? Why? Why has it been so reluctant, not simply to lead, but even to allow others to lead?
Let me step back a little bit and really bring to you here a debate I provoke quite often with Germans. Yeah. Germany has not yet realized that it is the key country of European Union. And this means, first of all, the geographic position of Germany. We are at the heart of Europe. We have 9 neighbors, more than anyone else. Yeah. And we are the biggest by inhabitants, 82 million, 83 million even. We are either economically too strong, which is the case today, or economically too weak, which was the case some 15 years ago. And my fellow compatriots in my European view behave quite often more by naivete, by a naive approach, than by a cynical or brutal approach. Nevertheless, when Germany takes a decision, and unfortunately in the past the Chancellor took a couple of decisions without consulting too much the neighbors and the European institutions, it has an immediate and extremely strong impact on European affairs, by the size, by the geopolitical position of Germany at the heart of Europe. Yeah. I will give you an example. Yeah. I personally was proud of my country and proud of Merkel when she said, in a quasi-Obama style, wir schaffen das, yes we can, when the refugees last year came to the German border. Yeah. And from a moral point of view and from a humanitarian point of view, from the point of view of European values, that was the the action which has to be taken, and these were the words which were right. The dark side, yeah, of what I'm saying is she didn't ask any of the neighbors before. She didn't even inform ahead others. Yeah, so it was a unilateral decision with a European consequence. And when I said that to my colleagues at the foundation last year, they were all stunned. I said, what are telling us? Well, we are convinced that she's doing the right thing. I said, that's not in doubt. Yeah, I'm absolutely sure that in the long run, everybody will say she did the right thing. But she did the right thing in the wrong way. In Europe, as a German chancellor, you can't act like this. It's as simple as that, yeah. And she and the country has to pay a price for that, yeah. There were other moments when, for example, in 2009, 2010, at the very beginning of the euro crisis, yeah, of course, one should be fair and say all our politicians were confronted to something which was so new to them, yeah, that the whole set of rules and of practices suddenly didn't seem to work anymore. They had to invent from scratch solutions. Yeah. And the problem at that time was that for a couple of weeks, the German government seemed to be ready to kick Greece out of the euro. In my view, a catastrophe, because this would be the beginning of the end of the euro, yeah, not so much about the Greece-German relationship, which by history, historically, is a very, very close one. Yeah. When the Greeks had the military dictatorship in their country, many young Greeks came to Germany to first for protection and then, of course, to stay. And they studied, they speak fluently German. Yeah. We have a whole set of ministers who had their good years as youngsters in Germany, yeah, and who never forgot about that. Yeah. And suddenly we talk about the Greek people as of being lazy, sitting in the sun and eating their olives all day. Yeah. That was really the image in public opinion in Germany. Yeah. And a government which is at that moment cold-blooded and not ready to show that they understand that there are problems behind this problem of the euro and the position of Greece inside the euro, yeah, has not, to be fair, not the best approach to solve the problem. Yeah. There are others examples, I won't go on bother you with these. Yeah. Key message is Germany quite often ignores about its key role in Europe. When I say Germany, it's of course the acting government, also the opposition in the Bundestag, but also the media quite often are not fair play with neighbors. Yeah. They can become very arrogant, not only with the Greeks, but also with the Italians and the French. Yeah. And this makes that we have, of course, among the seven crises, always a German element in it. I wouldn't go as far as to say German is at the origin of this particular crisis, number one, number three, or number five. No, that's not my point here. But if Germany doesn't act and react in a correct European way, we have a European crisis. The force of Germany is as such that when Germany decides, the others are immediately concerned in their home affairs.
Yeah, that's very interesting. It seems to me that they're very different visions of Germany. If we just take the Eurozone crisis, for example, I mean, we already talked about the refugee crisis and sort of Merkel seeming to be an angel. But in terms of the role of Germany in the Eurozone crisis, there are those who'd argue that in the Council, in the European Council, Germany was essentially a dictator. you mentioned Germany's economic weight, also its political weight. If we think about Schäuble in the Eurogroup and in 2015 and the third Greek crisis, I think people were largely horrified by that game. I mean, not that Varoufakis came across very well either, but sort of a real concern. And I say that on the one hand, sort of Germany seems to be dictating everything, and tremendous concern about by lots of people, in particular Southern Europe, about the rules. Austerity and structural reform that hasn't worked, that means that Southern Europe is really not growing and also not allowed to invest because that would breach the rules. So I say all of that, and yet one has to balance this out a bit by recognizing that, after all, everyone agreed to the rules. So is the power, is Germany simply exercising its brute power, or has it been able to persuade other member states that this is the way? I mean, that's one question. I guess the other question is, why is Germany, you know, pushing these particular kinds of rules that aren't working? And the Bertelsmann Foundation, in fact, has written report after report demonstrating that these rules don't work, that there ought to be a whole range of other things that one could do. So is it about ideology? Is it about sort of ordo-liberalism and sort of an assumption that only through stability are you going to manage things, which obviously hasn't worked?
Well, today when we talk about Germany, we see Germany as maybe the reluctant hegemon, but as a strong part of European Union, yeah, because we have nearly full employment. We are once again expert champion of the world, and yeah.
There are those who would argue that yes, at the expense of the rest of Europe, given the large surplus as opposed to the deficit for other countries.
Yeah, we can talk about the export rates further on. I'd like to invite you for a short flashback. Yeah, go back to 2004, 2005. Yeah, Germany was not strong. Germany was weak. Germany had not full employment, but an employment crisis. And who were the two beggars who went to Brussels to ask not to apply the stability pact in full? France and Germany. So one of the early sinners in this game is, in fact, Germany. And at that time, I had discussions with many economists, high civil servants from Germany, who told me, no, that is just for a short period, that we need that. And indeed, the facts proved they were right in the Schröder government, Chancellor Schröder's government at that time. But there's a but, The door was open now, And in the following, they suddenly rediscovered their orthodox approach, because they were stronger, they were no more begging for anything. They said, no, the text is the text. We have to apply the rules. You have to play by the rules. I always said, no, that is not... I would turn the argument around. That is so typical German, that it might offend others. Why is this so typical German? Because, first of all, we have a long tradition of texts written by lawyers who should be respected more or less like a Bible. This goes back to 18th century. We had always strong Kanzleien, the chancelleries in the German states, the 300 and something, were always the strong place who try to keep politically things in hand. And they were dictating texts to their people. So this is a kind of very specific German tradition. In France, they would immediately say, yeah, a law is like a proposal, or a little bit more than a proposal. Yeah. It's an invitation to reflect, to discuss, and to find a solution. On s'arrange, let's make an arrangement at the end of the day. Yeah. So different culture. Yeah. And Germans don't understand these others, and other Europeans quite often don't understand what Germany is doing there. Yeah. Comes in a second feature which should be more familiar to you as a political economist, yeah, is we have since the Second World War a very specific kind of liberalism called Ordoliberalismus. This is a whole school of economists which started during the oppression of the Nazis in secret, and once Germany was freed from Hitler and the Nazism, yeah, they proposed that as a kind of part of the constitutional law. I would go beyond the unconstitutional laws of Germany, which is ordoliberalism. Yeah. Ordoliberalism is very, very difficult to translate and very, very difficult to explain to others. Yeah. The advantage of this was that in the beginning, in the 50s and 60s, this kind of economic school of economists participated largely in the quick success of Germany. So the Germans could get the idea that this is the best way to do things. And one of the principal ideas is don't give the politicians all possibilities to manipulate the economic standards like interest rates and leave that to independent institutions like the Deutsche Bundesbank. And when it came to the creation of the euro, yeah, one of the conditions of Germany was, particularly in the harsh dialogue they had with the French government at that time, yeah, we accept to drop our mark, which is the symbol for a post-war German of success, yeah, under the condition that the whole institutional setting for the euro is shaped after the model of ordoliberal Germany. Yeah. And that makes that the ECB today is so independent. Yeah. Who are the first to complain about? The Germans. And I always say to them, yeah, but you asked in 89, 90, you asked for that. Yeah, that was one of your preconditions there for the euro. Yeah, so don't complain too much. Yeah, and look back what happened in the 80s and 70s. All German chancellors, from Willy Brandt to Helmut Schmidt to Helmut Kohl, had strong fights with the president of the Bundesbank because of his independence. Yeah. But this means that it is a success story for Germany. It is a role model, yeah, and they are not, I would say, not elastic enough, yeah, to imagine that other solutions might be less orthodox, yeah, but also successful. Yeah,
you're raised a number of very important points. Your comment about France reminds me that de Tocqueville once said that the rule is rigid, the application flexible. And 50% of the time, of course, you can make exceptions to the rules and make them more adapted. Clearly, ordoliberalism assumes a kind of stability. It's kind of a neoliberalism with rules, an assumption that public law is the way to run things, et cetera. But maybe let's move from the Eurozone crisis, we can always go back to this, to a crisis that you didn't really mention, but I would call it the crisis of democracy. Rise of populism, but also you mentioned the Central and Eastern European countries, the Visegrad countries. If we think about Poland and the Kaczynski twin, if we think about Hungary and Orban and the touting of the illiberal democracy, I mean, how do you respond to that? And I'm not going to blame Germany for this, obviously.
No, no, I think it's not our fault in that case. But that is one of the points, by the way, where we haven't mentioned yet very much of the European institutions, but this is a point where I'm extremely disappointed by the European Commission. Yeah. It is their job to push in this direction. Yeah. And it's not only Hungary, it's not only Poland. One should have an eye on France. France, for reasons we all can understand, yeah, after the terrorist attacks, yeah, suspended civil rights in a form which was not seen ever since end of Second World War. Yeah. It is really... a French policeman can open this door without having any judge behind, yeah, and he can limit your rights in a way where I would say be careful not to apply these rights of exception too often. Yeah, what's going on in Poland and in Hungary is they were deprived of national pride for decades. Yeah. And there is a more psychological revolt in all this than transformed and translated into a political attitude, which is understandable only against the background of half a century of communism and dictatorship and uniformism. Yeah. Suddenly they feel free and they like to be recognized as Poles inside the community. And what is in both cases very interesting and for me even a bit bizarre, Poland and Hungary are, in the opinion polls, among the most pro-European people we have in Europe. Yeah. Less skepticism, less populism in the form of Brussels go away, leave us alone, yeah. A will, yeah, really to fight with Brussels and with the other European partners over a kind of proper role they like to apply to themselves. Yeah, populism. Yeah. Populism is now you have populist parties all over Europe. Yeah, in all member states you have them. Yeah, perhaps with the exception of Luxembourg. Yeah, if I'm right. Yeah, and you have the UKIPs in Great Britain. Yeah, you have Podemos, left-wing populism in France. You have Syriza in government in Greece. Yeah, you have AfD most recently in Germany. They have common features, but they have great differences too. Yeah, if you go to European Parliament and observe the far right wing, yeah, Nigel Farage never made a formal handshake with Marine Le Pen. On the contrary, he stayed away all the time of the Brexit campaign from her and say, no, no, that's not my cup of tea. Yeah. And same is true for other parties from the far right who are represented in the European Parliament. So you have common features which are we, they are they, and they should stay out, meaning quite often migrants, refugees, Muslims. And second feature is in common, things were much better the time before. And when you ask which time before, they become a little bit cloudier. But they have this kind of dream of things were better without and before. Then, of course, they have a clear tendency to say no to European Union in the existing form, quite often to NATO in the existing form. Some say we are ready to leave. Others say we prefer to limit their powers. Yeah, all these elements play a role, but do they are developing because of the existence of the European Union, or are they developing because there are problems which normally European Union should solve and is not capable for the time being to solve? Yeah, and then they say we don't need that. Yeah. That Brussels and so on. Yeah. the crisis, and you, Vivian, you were absolutely right to start with this, the crisis starts on the national level there. It is not a crisis which stems from European Union and its institutions. It stems from a deep homegrown crisis in our member state countries. Yeah. It has to do with the refusal of the elites, elites meaning the whole establishment, journalists, experts like me, politicians. Yeah. They say a clear no. There's a soupçon where they always say these are liars. Yeah. They don't tell the truth. Yeah. So therefore we go by other modern communication means. Yeah. And they say we are the people. Yeah. Meaning nobody else, so they are all anti-pluralistic, yes, they are not ready to accept minority views, yeah. And they are quite often against the like in France, the marriage for everybody, meaning for all kind of sex and gender, yeah. They refuse that too, yeah. So it's a funny mixture. It is looking backwards, yeah, but it is not a conservative movement. Yeah. On the contrary, it's reactionary, yeah, and it is modern. Yeah. They are in part of this modernity which causes so many problems to all of us to face and to live with. And I'm sure that they will not disappear as quick as that. When I say they are anti-pluralistic, this is the negative aspect of the fact that they are capable to mobilize non-voters, which in a democracy is a good thing. But since they are not interested in mobilizing voters to improve democracy, but to say we are we and we like to be at the place of the elites today, and when we are once in, we will see. There's a famous quote by Beppe Grillo, Cinque Stelle in Italy, who says, no, I have nothing against representation in parliaments and so on, yeah, as long as I get 100%. Yeah.
Yeah, so I guess the question would be, how do we explain it? I mean, it seems to me, and what do we do about it? Because it seems to me that you have the extreme right essentially setting the agenda. And it's an interesting agenda, because at the same time that they are anti-immigrant, racist, nationalist, nativist, they're also pro-welfare state. Mm-hmm. And it seems to me that the center-right is chasing after the votes of the extreme right, and the left seems to be chasing out after the votes of the center, so that everyone is moving. You mentioned the case of France and their draconian security laws. That is clearly sort of an attempt to appeal to right-wing voters or extreme-right voters. So how do we explain? So, is it about security and terrorism, or is it, given that they support the welfare state, is it about the unemployment that you mentioned before, or is it actually about the EU? You said it wasn't, but is it simply the presence of the EU that, when you're a citizen, you vote at the national level, and you vote against this or that, and you have no say because the rules seem to be made in Brussels? And you can vote out your leaders as much as you want, but they come back and do the same, and a new group comes in, and they do the same policies, in particular in terms of the Eurozone. I mean, Greece is the best example of that. With the referendum in 2015, you say no, and oh, no means yes. Wait, what? Yeah, sorry.
No, it's a mix of all this, and of course, when I turn my eyes to the citizen, yeah, not so much to the political system or to the leading actors, yeah, I find always fear, lots of fear, yeah, justified or not is a different question. Yeah, lots of anger. They are angry people. Yeah. In some countries, but not in all, I will give you the exceptions immediately. In some countries, of course, economic and social frustration, yeah, where you have high unemployment rates or unemployment rates for a long time, of course, people start to feel frustrated. The two interesting cases in this perspective are Germany and Austria. In Austria, we might get, end of the year, the first extreme right-wing president of a member state, Mr. Hofer, and Austria has a little bit more problems than last year, but it is an economy which is extremely well off. So it's not possible to explain that by economic factors. Same thing for AfD in Germany. We have polls over the last couple of months which show that the Germans, despite all the threats coming from globalization, terrorism, and so on, are in their private life as well off as never before. If they are asked, how do you feel? I personally, it's wonderful. Next question, politically, thumb down, And therefore, this psychological mix is not easy to explain with one or two arguments. I just realize that the key element is always a fear, it's always an anger, and always a clear no. It is impossible to go on this path. We like to have another one. And then the idealization of the past starts, and all these other elements. Also illusionist ideas. To take an example, which is perhaps not the typical extreme right wing example, is UKIP's in England, the Brexiteers won, because of the fear of immigration from the inside the European Union, not from outside. Some experts, analysts said, but behind this fear is the other fear that they could suffer the same fate as Germany is confronting now. I always said I can't see that. They are quite clear in their words. They are afraid of the Polish plumber and the Polish nurse. And if you check with economists from United Kingdom, and you say, okay, now when the new government now has the right to apply stricter rules on immigration, what would happen? They all say they won't apply that, because our economy needs these immigrants. We have big projects in England, like, for example, the fast trains, the new nuclear plants. We don't have the qualified workers to execute that. We need immigration. And the English only here, they are coming. So this mixture of ignorance, fear, glorifying a past and being afraid of the future is psychologically perhaps a common feature, but country by country it differs in the way it comes down in the political life.
Which takes us back to leadership. And I guess the rejection of the leaders that we have, or the failure of the leaders we have it's not just in Europe, but we're not talking about the U.S. here. So I guess given all of this, you mentioned a number of crises. We've talked about the rise of populism. We've talked about the crisis of democracy. We've talked about the role of Germany. How do we get from here to the future? What is the future of the EU, in particular with Brexit, with the UK out, if it will be out, or it's slightly in? How do we think about the future?
Well, to start with an easy answer, as a director and a team leader, in such a situation, I would say to my team, always keep calm and carry on. And this is perhaps
not helpful.
No, this is not an advice which you can translate in big politics. I see that, But where comes the admiration, you mentioned that already, for Angela Merkel from? She's somebody extremely reasonable, extremely controlled, extremely calm. We can discuss the decisions she has taken, but the way she took them made her quasi invulnerable, until last summer. And even today, I would say she has her chances to be re-elected. depends on the whole set, not only on her. Yeah, and the way she acts and behaves, even in an international crisis like the Ukrainian crisis, yeah, shows that with this kind of attitude, yeah, of self-control, yeah, you can impress people, yeah. If I might compare this for a second to Hollande, yeah, who's hesitating, to Cameron, yeah, who took decisions which were simply a catastrophe for himself as well as for his country, yeah. You have other examples where politicians are well below, punching well below the weight Angela Merkel brings in. Yeah. And if you ask the future question, John Maynard Keynes is always welcome in this case. It's so unforeseeable, the problem with the future. Yeah, I'm sure that Europe will, and Europe's leaders will wake up. Yeah, when they feel the pressure from outside becoming overheated and very, very high. Yeah. Perhaps, and that sounds a bit cynical, the pressure is not high enough now. Yeah, we have an idea how quickly it can become overheated. We haven't mentioned Putin until now. Yeah, we mentioned the refugee crisis from the Arabic countries and from Africa. Yeah, we now get an idea what all this could mean for us. Yeah. And perhaps the pressure will bring up leadership. Yeah, that's my hope.
Okay, so I think I just want to thank you for a wonderful set of remarks, very enlightening and illuminating, and thank you all for being here. And
this is Boston University's World of Ideas. You just heard a discussion presented by the Boston University Center for the Study of Europe, the Frederick S. Pardee School of Global Studies, and the Goethe Institute Boston. Our discussion was titled Quo Vadis Europe? Our speaker was Joachim Fritz Vanama, director of the think tank Europe's Future at the Bertelsmann Stiftung. Tonight's moderator was Center for the Study of Europe founding director Vivian Schmidt, and we began with an introduction by Christoph Mutcher, director of the Goethe Institute Boston. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. You can also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Michael Garth with help from Ian McCarn. The executive producer of Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydonis. I'm Jack Lepiars. Thanks for joining us.